This is a Glassbox Media podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than they're worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we delve into those difficult moments with some well-known guests. I'm Giles Paley-Phillips and with me today is James Dore-Daly. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's my unofficial...
way too enthusiastic. How you doing?
I'm good. That's my Facebook name, James Dore-Daly. It's not my official... It will be our official. We're too lazy. We haven't merged our names yet. It will be at some point.
So you've got to do it by depot, have you?
I don't know. Like, I think you have to get a new passport or, do it somewhere.
That costs you 30, 40 quid, mate. Each.
Exactly. If not more. Passport would be another 80, wouldn't it, to get it on there?
Yeah. Passport's £100, isn't it, for a passport?
That's ridiculous. So it's Facebook official, but
and
it's
soon
not.
You won't be able to travel anywhere in Europe.
So what's the point? What's the point in having a passport?
You don't want to go to America, so where are you going to go?
I'll just tear it up. Exactly, yeah. Completely pointless. But anyway, I'm good. How are you?
I've just alienated half our listeners from around
the world. Actually, I slagged off America during... during this episode, I may have slagged off America. I want to get it on record that I love America. I think I've been there many times. I've been to over half the states. I've got good friends over there. I feel like a politician trying to
diplomatically get your way
get
back
everyone
in.
Back on side.
Now you've got someone in charge you like.
Let me be clear. America is a wonderful country. No, it's great. But obviously, at the moment, things are looking up, actually, in America now.
Yeah.
January 20th, I will want to go there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was only teasing, of course. I know. Yes, America's a great country. All the music and films and literature, incredible. Yeah. So we have
I wonder if we have American listeners.
We do. Quite a few. Yes, we do. Across the whole country, in fact.
Oh, fantastic! Good.
So if you are listening from the States, thank you very much for listening.
And tweet me and tell me where you're from, because I'll see if I've been.
Jim's probably been there, because he sounds like he spent most of his youth training people to play football. So
this is why the USA soccer team is so bad.
Well, I was going to say, actually, is there been there's been obviously a rise in quality since you were there.
Yeah, they're still not that good, unfortunately.
Not in the national team. I just meant in general.
In general, maybe, probably not. I wasn't a very good coach. I really wanted to muck around more than I wanted to actually coach kids. But it was good fun.
Did you do like drills and stuff, or was it just playing five-a-side?
Yeah, they used to give us like a. I would just play five-a-side, but they used to give us like a massive manual, like this big coaching manual, with like all drills to do and stuff. And then once you'd been there a couple of times, and like I'd done it 2 or 3 years, you had your own games that you played.
Yeah.
You just make them up, or with other coaches, you'd get the best thing to do was like towards the end of the week, merge your group with another coach's group, and then just get them playing this game that takes like 20 minutes, and you can just like sit and chat to the coach and like have a cup of tea. And then MLS camps folded a few years after I did my last summer. So that's the MLS camps and the Uckfield Courier.
I was going to say, following on from the Uckfield Courier, I mean, this pod's still going at the moment, but you know.
Give it time. I'll close it eventually. But yeah, no, I do love the old US of A. So much love to anyone that's over there. Yes. And Canada.
Canada's a great country.
Canada's a great country.
Yeah. Thanks, Canadians.
And anyone, it's in any other country.
Well, no, we love all countries. Everyone's welcome.
Yeah.
Fun fact for you this week, Jim, is that Blank Podcast has become number one in Tanzania.
How about you sent me that? Yeah.
Yeah, the number one podcast. So that was exciting.
That is interesting. Mm. That is. We've also been up there in Cuba.
Yep, we've been number
Sweden
one in Cuba.
At one point.
And I think Sweden. Yep. So yeah, amazing. I mean, thank you to our listeners in Tanzania and in Cuba and Sweden. You
know, my brother once went to Tanzania and spent a summer there.
Was he listening to our podcast?
I don't actually think he listens. And this is in 2009 or 2008, and he went. A friend of ours who I'd met in San Francisco ran a school or was setting up a school for local kids in Tanzania, and Seb went over to take photos while they were building one of the schools or something. So yeah. I've never actually been to any African country, but he went to Tanzania and said he loved it. He said it's a really, really beautiful place. And the people there are just incredible and really, really welcoming. So shout out to whoever's listening in Tanzania.
Yeah, thank you.
We love
you. It's just lovely to know that you're listening. And it was always nice to see that you're number one somewhere in the world.
Yeah,
you know, particularly those places you might not have visited yourself. So that's lovely to know.
Well, when we do live performance is back,
we go down to Tanzania.
Guest, actually, we talk about this. Well, we'll do our world tour and we'll stop off all the places we've been number one. So we'll go Tanzania, Sweden, Cuba, and then home. Three leg tour.
Whistle stop.
But that would be nice, wouldn't it? One day we've done one live podcast at Latitude, which was amazing. Be nice to do more, wouldn't it, at some point when we're
we'll definitely do some more live ones. It'd be lovely to do some live ones. I'm going to read out a tweet.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, let me get one as well.
Before we reveal who this week's guest is, I've got a tweet here from the lovely Iona McKay. I've got to know Iona recently on social media. She's a really lovely person. She's a nurse, practicing nurse up in Scotland, and doing great work up there. So yeah, big shout out to Iona, and she's put, well, that's a good start to my Tuesday day off, listening to Emma Kennedy on the Blank Pod. The to-do list is a must, creative or not. Time to go tick some things off. Thank you guys, great pod.
Well, that's, I mean, big shout out to everyone working in the health sector or you know, doing bits at the moment. Obviously, God, working very hard. So big shout out to anyone, and thank you, Iona, for that lovely tweet.
Thanks, Iona.
Name. Iona's a lovely name as well.
Yeah. She's great. She's a really nice person. So, yeah, thank you for that.
I'm going to go and follow her and say thank you. I've got one here from someone called Sanjeev Bhaskar. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Yeah.
Rings a bell, doesn't it?
I think he's been on the podcast.
He says, I'm tidying day to day. So glad to have the company of some great podcasts. And then he's copied in. Let's see who's got. Film Stories Pod.
Mm-hmm.
Who Am I This Time with David Morrissey. Oh, we love David Morrissey.
Another former guest on the Blank Pod.
Greatest Game Pod. Jamie Carragher. Oh, we should get Jamie Carragher on the pod. And Blank Pod. Too many good pods, so little time. So there you go. Sanjeev continuing to give us shouts out on Twitter. What a legend.
And an owner of one of the coveted Blank Podcast t-shirts, which you can get from podcastmerch.co.uk.
Indeed. Wait, seamless. Seamless plugging. Very good. Speaking of seamless, shall we bring on... That's a terrible link. It doesn't work at all. Well, look, shall we crack on and introduce this week's guest? Because this is a really, really great episode.
Yeah, fantastic episode. I think you and I said afterwards we didn't laugh as much as this any other podcast. You know, we laughed so much.
Well, when you got the giggler.
Well, exactly. Nicknamed the giggler. And we can see why, because she's a right old giggler. It's Sian Harris, who's an absolute joy to be in the company of. Sian's probably best known for working on Man Down, which she co-wrote with Greg Davis. She did The Tourist Trap, which she performed in, and also starred Sally Phillips. So she's a comedy writer. She's a comedy performer. And you know, she tells us all about her journey into comedy, and you know, starting off going to school with the great stand-up comedian Ellis James, who they went to school together and university together, and kind of took their comedy journey together, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And she's just like, I mean, she's told us right at the start that she laughs a lot of things, and she was called the giggler at school, and it's really infectious, because I think you know, we laughed a lot as well, so it's a really, really fun guest and a really fun episode. I think we should just crack straight on.
I think we should.
This is the wonderful Sean Harries on the Blank Podcast.
You know, it's so good doing podcasts with podcasters. they've got all the equipment. It hasn't been deliberate, but for like the last sort of 10 guests have all done some sort of broadcasting recently, and really? Have either had the equipment or at least the knowledge. Whereas I think the beginning of lockdown, we were sort of having to explain to everybody how to record on GarageBand.
I would say that we spent 45 minutes explaining to Ronnie O'Sullivan the concept of GarageBand before he even pressed record. That was a long chat.
That's hilarious. No, but it's true though, isn't it? These are all different skills that we've all picked up. Yeah. You know, yeah. I didn't know how to do this before lockdown, but now it's the only time I get to talk to anybody, you know. So it's like, yeah, of course I can do editing.
I'll work it out.
Really, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it'll be fine. I'm sure I'll sort that out.
Because when did you start the podcast with Rod? When was that? Was that the beginning of the year?
It was just after lockdown, actually. Mm. And one of the main reasons we did start it was because we were just, you know, it's lovely for us. We get to see our friends. Mm. So it's just a really lovely way to hook up. So at the beginning, it was more to do with trying to keep ourselves sane.
Yeah, you know? Of course.
It was a really good way of seeing our friends every week for a laugh and to talk about stuff that wasn't to do with COVID or... Yeah, it was just a lovely way. So it kind of grew from that. I mean, we'd been wanting to do it for ages. And I think because we were locked in with each other, just bickering, you know, me and Rod bicker. And it was actually quite funny. Like, we make each other laugh and we bicker and stuff. And we were like, we have to get this down. Why don't we do the podcast? We've always talked about it. Why don't we record it and then see what happens?
It's fun- Yeah, it's funny that... the concept of bickering and arguing. Now, if I think, if you say you argue, people think there's something wrong with the relationship, but bickering is okay.
It's one level down.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah. It's like two levels down, isn't it? And it also suggests that you're very intimate with each other, which is good in a relationship. It's, you're very comfortable. And also, I think, I don't know, I think if you grow up with siblings, maybe you're used to that. Mm. It means closeness. It doesn't mean there's something wrong.
Yeah.
It means, oh, I really like that person, but we have to live with each other, you know, so it's you're comfortable with it.
It's quite a British thing, I think. I don't know if maybe like Americans don't, I don't know, apologies to any American listeners, but I think British, certainly siblings, I think it is your modus operandi, is that the right phrase? Modus operandi, to take the piss out of each other as much as possible. And then mates as well. Like, it's just
definitely
what we do.
Absolutely. I mean, I have friends, and the more we take the mick out of each other, the more it means that we adore each other. Yeah. You know, that kind of, and you know when things are bad because nobody has said anything to hurt each other for a while, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking the other day, actually, I've got a friend of mine who's my oldest friend, Dave, who we've talked about on the pod before. And he was
best, he comes up a lot.
Yeah. He's my oldest friend. He, as a child, he was the biggest piss taker. I mean, he would get in trouble with lots of, particularly older kids. He was that little kid. He was very small and slight. He was that little shit that took the piss out of the older kids. And sort of halfway through his life, that changed completely. And he became this very passive person, was never incited any kind of violence towards himself. I think maybe because of when he was younger, he did. And now he's become the biggest kind of sponge for abuse. Like, we just
it's gone full circle.
Yeah, it's come full circle. Like, it's it's karma, basically. And now he just gets regularly, you know, verbally abused at any given moment. And
really?
Yeah, and he gets, I mean, he probably gets the There's things I would say to him about himself that I wouldn't dream of saying to anybody else ever.
No, that's what I mean. Like with Greg Davis, who I wrote Man Down with, he and Rod, my husband, are really good friends. And so every time we phone each other up, we always answer and greet one another with, "Oh, you clown." You know, and it's really abusive. It's really abusive for the first 5 minutes. And then before you get to the any kind of, "Right, what are you up to then?" Yeah. You know, it's just such a joy. And I think I do it as well with Ellis James, because we went to school together. We were in primary school together and then big school. And then we lived together in university, so we're incredibly close. And the biggest laugh we've ever had one was in our friend's wedding, where we were a bit worse for wear, just telling each other to each other's faces, "You look fucking disgusting." You know what I mean? "You look disgraceful." And it was so funny. It was just tearing strips of each other. It's because clown, it's wrong.
Clown is a good one. Clown is an excellent one because it's quite low level, but it's actually quite cutting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's also our profession as well, so it is factual.
Very true.
Very true.
Yes, I am a clown.
Yes, and I wear it with pride.
Exactly.
I'm trying. I'm trying to be one.
Another one I like is Burke. Burke is a great one. Burke. Again, quite low level, but you know,
really
it's
low level.
We used to call each other like we used to say "you twirl," which I think is you twirl, like I mean, you have to do it in that kind of Cockney accent as well. You twirl,
yeah, you would have to.
what did that mean?
Well, like plonker, you're an idiot, you're a twat.
You twirl, that's great. Yeah. What, like the chocolate bar?
Basically, yeah. I don't know if it was like I don't know if it was like twirl was a bit of a rubbish chocolate bar to get. And so, you know, "Oh, you got a twirl, did you? You twirl."
"Oh, you fucking bounty." Yeah. "You fucking bounty." No one likes bounties. I think bounties underestimated. I think they're underestimated.
They're very filling, which is always really good. In a chocolate bar, sometimes, you know, when you're in a panic and your train's like 2 hours late and there's a vending machine and you're like, "I'm starving." Yeah. And you know, what is going to fill me up? So it's not going to be a packet of Maltesers. It's going to be a bounty, which you kind of have to get. You know, the first bite is quite nice. Towards the end, it's a bit too much. You know, there's too much going on. It's like you're eating shampoo. I don't know. But Snickers is a good one. Snickers is an absolute meal.
Yeah.
That's my go-to. That's my go-to.
It's amazing.
For a filling snack.
Yeah, I think bounty's quite valuable.
Well, not a snack in general. That makes me sound really unhealthy. I'd probably go for a bit of apple first. But if I was a vending machine...
You can't get apples in vendings.
You can't. I wouldn't trust an apple in a vending machine.
No. It would be all bruised by the time it came out. Like down the hole. Do you know what I mean? Oh, great.
Yeah, fruit in vending machines is not a good move,
Some
I don't think.
Bashed up fruit.
You just get a banana that's just gone...
Exactly. And how long has it been in there for?
Exactly, yeah. Oh, should I have a brown banana or a bruised apple?
Can you imagine a vending machine with avocados? They'd be changing them every 5 minutes to make sure that they're right. It'd be a nightmare.
Really expensive. Yeah. Everything's like 50p and the avocado's like £4. Just clink, 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 clink.
Oh, too late. Oh, shit.
Now, you said you grew up with Ellis. Were you messing about at school, and was comedy there from an early age?
Yes. Elle and I were in this class where we felt totally out of our depth because they were really lovely people, but just farmers. So it was me and Ellis with this whole bunch of farmers. And when I say farmers, they were so into farming, we couldn't talk about anything else. So, and we were from like farming stock. Like my grandparents were farmers, and so were Elle's. But we didn't know what we were talking about. So they would be constantly drawing tractors, talking about them. They would skive off sports day to go, you know, to farm. you know, things like this. Me and Elle lived in the town. So we lived in Carmarthen, this small town. So we clung to each other. We used to sit next to each other going, "I don't know what's going on." And also farmers are very physical. Like, they're so much bigger because they work like a man. Yeah. You know, they're all grown men. And me and Al were just like these little kids going, oh my God, we do not fit in here. So we kind of clung to each other and we became very, very good mates. And we used to make each other laugh. And I was thinking about this the other day. My nickname in maths class was the giggler. Like the teacher used to call me the giggler. So I was clearly finding everything funny. And yeah, we pretty much laughed all the way through school. And then we went to the same university and we lived together. And yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
That's like so the, we know the giggler each other. Is like a the giggler is like a terrible Batman villain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The giggler. What's
yeah,
she gonna do?
It is, isn't
She's
it?
Just gonna laugh at you, to be honest.
She's
it's
so
quite annoying.
Irritating.
At most it's annoying.
I guess that God. Would to be honest, that would I think that would piss Batman off though if he just kept laughing at him.
Yeah.
You know, when he's doing yes. that especially Christian Bale when he's doing that Batman voice.
Yeah, he's quite serious. Yeah,
he takes
yeah.
himself very seriously.
You know, I'm Batman.
Exactly.
And then you just go
Are you?
Do you know what I mean? You're rabid.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that I was just thinking, did Ellis have a nickname? Was it just you that had a nickname?
Believe it or not, Ellis's nickname is Ellis because his real okay. name, well, his real, his first name is Owain, but somebody yeah. found out that his second name was Ellis and found it hilarious. So that stuck and it's just a normal name. So that was his derogatory name, you know. Kids are so weird, aren't they?
They are. They can be. Yeah, they certainly can
yes.
be. Yeah.
They can be, can't they?
Yeah. So what did you do at university then? What course were you doing?
I did journalism, film and broadcasting, and Al did history, modern history and politics. Yes. So we were on separate courses, but we lived in the same house. Me and Al and four the guys. So just me and loads of blokes.
Was it a classic student den?
Yes. Oh my God, yes. I mean, again, it was funny. I think... It's weird. I think finding everything really funny is a superpower, but it's also awful. Well, you know, it kind of, well, not awful, but it lets you thrive in awful situations, which is brilliant, but it also means that you don't necessarily notice if something is really bad and needs changing.
Or is
like
it
our
like...
student house.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, that's a right. That's a right passage, isn't it, living in a...
Yeah. Well, yes. You know the bit in them. There's a bit in Friends. I can't believe I'm quoting Friends, where Rachel goes to live with Joey, and she spills some bolognese, and she's like, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." And he's like, "It's fine." And then so she throws some more on the floor and finds it funny, and he's like, "Well, don't waste it." Like, that's what our student house.
Okay. Like.
We would find mess really funny, and you know, how bad can we make it? And isn't this? We found, what did we find? Like a wedding cake. We found a wedding cake in one of the cupboards. And we don't know, I don't think we knew whose that was. Like a full-on wedding cake. We were all 18 or 19. We found a wedding cake. There was also a rat who lived under the sink.
Oh, God.
There was, I mean, just mad that they kept from me. They didn't tell me because I was a girl. And so they were like, "Shan, I don't want to break it to you, but there is a rodent
a large
living
one.
Under the sink." Yeah, exactly. But it was just great. It was so much fun. Wonderful.
What uni were you at?
Cardiff.
No, Cardiff, yeah.
Yeah. So
I think
it was,
I applied there. I think I,
did
actually,
you?
I think I applied to do that course, possibly. Certainly a journalism course of some sort.
The journalism one.
Yeah, I didn't get accepted. I didn't get accepted to any of my top three.
Where
I
did
think.
You go?
So I went to Southampton. At the time, it was called Southampton Institute.
Yeah, did you do
in hindsight, not a complimentary or appropriate name.
No, because it does sound like you're going to be housed there.
It changed name in life. In my third year, it changed name to the much more appropriate Southampton Solent University. But it was the Institute. As you can imagine, students from the main university in Southampton used to find that quite funny and take the piss
yes,
out of us
of course.
Mercilessly.
Did you do journalism?
I did journalism, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's good, isn't it?
It's all right. It's all right.
I think it gives you a really good kind of preparation for, well, it has for me anyway, you know, that kind of analytical skill that you take on into further life and you can use anywhere. So you can watch the news and go, well, that's nonsense. You know, or
which
you
we're
can...
all doing all the time right now anyway. think yes. it's good for comedy, actually, because it makes you perceptive yeah. to the world, and it makes you write yes. really tight yes. copy.
Pithily. Yeah. And then that kind of drip feeding thing, isn't it, where you start with the top line and then give more as you go along. Yeah. And it's fascinating. What I'm really finding interesting at the moment is all these older people, love them, who are just starting to get into Facebook and digital news and are just bombarded by it. And because they've never studied media or media studies and having mocked it for so many years, or media studies, that's not a proper subject, are actually unable now to analyse what's true and what isn't. Whereas I think people who have studied media are going, well, that's not true. What's the source? You know, yeah. And it's this kind of life skill that's only becoming really important right now. Well, we're seeing the fruits of it, I think.
It was. It's funny, actually. Yeah. I was thinking about a college. There was tourism and leisure or media studies, and they were the sort of like MVQ subjects that, you know, the kids that didn't know what they couldn't do, you know, the sort of slightly less academic kids ended up doing. And actually, they're probably all like running the media now.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. For years, it was kind of looked at as, oh, it's just watching telly. Yeah, yeah. Whereas now, yeah. which let's be fair, that is why I got into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But now you're kind of, it's such an incredible skill to have that. It means the difference between being able to sort out what's real and what isn't real and not freaking out. I think it's so valuable.
Mm. I totally agree. I did communication studies at A-level, which is like one down from media studies. and then I did media studies at A-level again because I screwed up all the rest of my A-levels so I could go to university. I did that in a year, media studies. And you're so right. I thought communications would be a DOS subject.
Yeah, DOS basically.
And in many ways it was. Although I had an amazing teacher who's one of the few teachers whose name I can remember, Mrs. Ruffle, and she was just so great. She really believed in me. She was amazing.
Oh, that's so good.
She was great. Oh, I wonder if she's still
it's
there.
It's so lovely when you have a teacher who believes in you. That's worth anything. That's 100% what the subject is.
Especially at that age when you don't really know what you're doing and you don't really feel like you fit in. You know, you're saying about that earlier. To have a teacher who's like, you're doing fine. You're doing great. Oh, keep doing what you're doing. You're going to be okay. And I've ended up doing media and broadcasting and stuff.
So, amazing.
Yeah. It's just...
You should try and find her, Jim.
Mrs. Ruffle. I'm going to Google her now, actually.
Do a shout out.
See if she's still around. Because I think she'd... I think she'd really love to know what you're doing. That you've got like a YouTube channel and you do podcasts and that you're trying
Imagine
to be a stand-up comedian.
Imagine how chuffed she'd be.
The best thing about Mrs. Ruffle was at the top of the paper she'd print out, obviously her login for like the school printers would be at the top, and her first name started with an A, so it would say Ruffler. Yeah, and I always thought that Ruffler sounded like some sort of Ruffler, like some sort of like the Gruffalo or something.
Yeah, like a magic animal. Yeah, who kind Ruffler. Of gives you yeah. that's so I'm good that gave you confidence.
Yeah, she really did. Really
so was that what you were going to go into then, Sian, was the journalism stuff? Was that what...
I did go into
you
it.
You did?
I worked in... yes, I did go into it. I started off as a... what was it? Like an assistant floor manager in a TV company.
Oh, okay.
Which was so much fun. It was so much fun. I met a really big group of like-minded people who... And we were all earning, you know, we weren't earning much money, but it was that time where you're just learning and... You're all into music and film, and we spent every waking moment together making TV. Like it's kind of like it was the equivalent of This Morning, but in Welsh and for Welsh language TV, okay. I suppose. And it was so much fun because you learnt so much, and you know we'd make these packages which were like too long and about things like how to put a curtain pole up. You know what I mean? And and they'd be like 18 minutes long of a man drilling, but and you know we weren't taking it incredibly seriously, but we learned so much, and that's such a brilliant company to work for in terms of it taught us everything we needed, and I'm still in touch with them. They're such lovely people, and you know they've all gone on to be really good, and cameramen, sound men, editors, filmmakers, they're brilliant. And so that's where I started. Then I went to work at the BBC in Cardiff, the news department. So I was in news for a while. And even though I think I'm naturally curious about the world and I love finding things out and researching, I didn't enjoy news. I felt like I didn't fit in there because it was too... I mean, my nickname is The Giggler. I was out of my depth. You know what I mean? If something bad happened, I'd either tear up immediately. I feel things too much.
Yeah.
Or I would find things funny when they weren't funny.
Yeah.
As a defense thing.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's hilarious. Like, they're not, it's not really Sean.
Yeah. People died. 100 people died.
I have to deal with it in my own way. You know, so I decided to leave there. But I'd always been writing comedy since school. Me and Elle wrote this really bad comedy sketch together in school for the Schoolist Edward. It was just awful, but it was such a... And me and Elle had then written together throughout university, casually.
What was the sketch?
In school?
Yeah.
In Welsh language schools, they have Eisteddfods. Have you heard, do you know what an Eisteddfod is? It's like a big festival where you dance, sing, recite. It's a big, huge pagan thing that's been going on for centuries.
Wow.
And it's wonderful. And every school has one. So once a year, there'll be a day where all kids are competing in singing competitions, dancing, comedy sketch. It's just this thing, and every school does it. And Elle and I had written this sketch. I can't remember. We were in Form 6, so we'd written it for the younger kids. Honestly, it was awful. I can't even... Do you know what I mean? You'd put some classics in, like somebody would do an impression of the woodwork teacher, which would get an eruption.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Play to
the
crowd.
Room would erupt.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, I can't even... If I tell you, it's out of context.
In sixth form, I did the staff room sketch.
Did you?
Yeah,
did
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Amazing.
I got to be the... I cast it, so I got to be the cool PE kind of / guitar teacher. So so I played him. And then the headmaster's son was in it as well, but he didn't play his dad. He played like the the deputy head, who was a woman. He was really keen to do the drag thing.
Cool.
So that was fine. So he did that, yeah. It went down a storm, I have to say. It's the best thing I've ever... It's probably the best thing I've ever done.
Peaked early.
I peaked really early. Really early.
It all went downhill. It's the kind of child equivalent of the best man speech,
yeah,
isn't it?
It
like,
is.
Everybody is like, come on.
It's easy
Anything
gags.
You say.
They're easy gags, though, because, you know, you just dress like the teacher.
Yes.
And then you just kind of put on a silly voice and...
Or, woman. You just dress woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, such a laugh.
We were quite cutting. It was quite satirical in places. I'm probably making it sound better than it was. But there was one teacher who had quite very softly spoken voice, and we did rip the piss out of her quite badly. I remember, like, the character that the child that played her was like, doing this really croaky kind of exorcist kind of voice. And I remember looking at that teacher and she looked quite upset, actually.
Oh no.
We went too far, probably, but it's still the best thing I've ever done.
Probably. Those poor teachers. You never gave a thought to how they would actually feel.
I know.
Just like, yeah, let them have it.
Yeah. Those wankers.
Exactly. God. Yeah. What were we talking about? So then I got into journalism. Oh no.
Yeah.
I got into.
I've been desperate to tell that story for years.
97 podcasts you've held on to that.
I love the fact that. Hang on. You were sport and you gave yourself a guitar.
Yeah.
Is that right?
No. He played the. So he. It turned out actually.
Oh, I see. He played.
Yeah. He played the guitar. He didn't do guitar lessons, but in his own time, he played the guitar. It turned out, years later, we found out he was some sort of folk guitar playing champion. Like, he'd won some folk awards for his, like, finger-picking style.
For the kids, that's an easy target. That is an easy target.
Well, I think I just played him as really cool, like, with his, like, leg up on the side. Like, didn't really give a toss about the kids and stuff. He was just, like, all image.
Yeah.
I sort of played him a bit like David Hasselhoff, basically. That was what I was going for.
Brent. I'm thinking Brent.
Well, yeah, a bit Brent, a bit Hasselhoff. Yeah. Anyway,
We had a teacher who, if you wanted to get out of work, if you wanted to not do the work, it was wood. Oh, I'm not going to say who it is. It was in his class. If you wanted to get out of doing any work, you would ask him about his guitar.
Yes.
And then he would get it out and like show you stuff, and you'd be like, right, okay, and then you just start reading magazines. You know, every time, sir, you know, you showed us like a D minor last time.
I did something. Oh my god! Funny, we had a DT teacher or CDT teacher who was really obsessed.
They're always
with
DT.
Yeah, he was really into comic books, and I stupidly said that I liked comic books in one lesson, and he just talked for an hour about all these different comic book stuff, and everyone was really, really fucked off with me afterwards. They were like, what the fuck? Why did you bring up Marvel? He just wouldn't shut up about it. We couldn't get on. They were like, we wanted to do our work.
Oh, wow.
The one lesson. We actually wanted to do stuff. And he wouldn't shut up about Thor and Iron Man.
In our school, you'd have been carried out on both shoulders, like on two shoulders. Like, oh my God, this guy.
Fuck it to the man.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Yes. Well, I left journalism because I was laughing too much. And also I've been writing comedy on the side, and I knew that I wanted to be in a more, in a profession where I could laugh.
Yeah.
And not get into trouble. So that's why I got out of it. But it's really handy. I love the fact that I have a background in news, because I've gone on to write satirical stuff. Mm. And I think once you've got a background in news, it can't quite leave you, because you just have this mine of knowledge of what both parties have done over the years. Yeah. And you have a grasp of it. You're not starting from scratch. So yeah, it's been really, really handy.
So what was the first writing stuff that you did then, when you stopped? Was there a point where you thought, I want to take the comedy stuff further? You know, you decided that the news thing, you know, wasn't for you.
Yes. I got the sack. Not from the...
For laughing.
Not from the news. Not from the news. It was my fault. It was really... I was young and I was silly, and I locked up an art gallery before I was meant to lock it up, and I flew to Edinburgh, the Edinburgh Comedy Festival. And because Rod, who was my boyfriend at the time, was up for the Perrier Award, and I was kind of I couldn't find out if I could go. There was no way of finding out whether I could go to this, and I couldn't. So I made the executive decision to lock up early and fly there, because the award ceremony was happening that evening. And he didn't win. But I just thought, this is the man I'm going to be with for the rest of my life. This is, to date, one of the most important nights of his life. Yeah, I want to be there with him, you know. And so I locked up, and then I came back and got the sack. Got the sack. But then it was great, because it gave me a kick up the bum, because it meant, A, I had more time, and B, I have to make this work now, because I have not got any other money coming in. So I did. Yeah. I made it work. And I started by... writing,
locking up
certainly
a gallery too quickly, a sack pool offence. That sounds quite low level, really. Don't do it next time.
Well, it's kind of in breach of contract, and you know what I mean. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's very rom com. It's very kind of, you know what I mean. It was so rom com, and to be fair, I went, you know, after he lost, we all went out we all went out. And then I flew back literally the next morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, going and opening up an art gallery. I think it was expected. So, but it was great, because it gave me a kick, and I needed that. And sometimes you do need that.
Yeah.
You know, so I started writing kids' TV then.
Oh, did you?
I started writing... Yeah, well, Ellis and I had already written something for S4C called Llew at Blew, which is a lion who holds a comedy night in a zoo. And so we'd written a little series of that, which was really fun. That was so much fun. So I'd been doing that alongside working in the gallery. So I wrote another couple of episodes for Igamogam, who was being made by the same company, which was brilliant. And then Ellis and I, we started a sketch group with quite a few other people at the comics. So Henry Packer, Josh Widdicombe, Tom Crane, Nat Latima, Ben Partridge. Who else was there? Henry Widdicombe. Oh, Mike Wozniak as well. So there were nine of us in this sketch group, which is an enormous amount of people. We had to take two cars to every gig or like a minibus. And so we started this group and it was so much fun. And that's it, really. We went to the next Edinburgh. We went up and did a show. So we did a show every day. I also appeared in Mark Watson's The Hotel, which was this brilliant improvised show where people came round and interacted with us in this big mad hotel. And then, yeah, I didn't, that's it. And by that, you know, by that point, I was kind of in comedy, which, so it felt like, well, I can't really go back to it now because I'm really enjoying writing and performing.
Because say, did you enjoy the performance side of it?
Yes. Yes, definitely.
Because you're just giggling the whole time.
I'm weirdly good at being deadpan when I need to be. When I'm pretending, I'm weirdly good at, Rod can't do it, but I can. It's brilliant. It's so good. And yes, I really enjoyed the performing side because you have an element of control over what comes from your writing. So whatever you've created and the words you've come up with and the voice, you can execute it yourself, which I find very rewarding.
Yeah, is there something magical about you having written the sketch and then you performing
it? Yes. And I think it depends on the character. So for the Tourist Trap series we did for BBC Wales, I play a passive-aggressive masseuse. And so when I created her, and so when I write her, it's me talking and then I write it down maybe, but actually I write it in the room because she just comes out, which is so enjoyable. And also it's brilliant because you can't, I'll have written a sketch and then in the room, say that I was playing opposite Sally Phillips or something else would come out because it was semi-improv anyway. But just that thing of, I don't know, the character just kind of comes through you, if you know what I mean, and you find what's funny in the moment, and there's something brilliant about that. It's such a lovely feeling.
Yeah, did you, sorry Jim,
I guess it's a control thing as well. Like, there aren't many aspects in life where you can have control over what you're doing. That's why I like doing stand-up as well, because although it's like really naked up there when it goes wrong, oh boy, it goes wrong.
Maybe you shouldn't do it naked, mate, I think. You should change your routine.
I didn't record this, or I
guess people
that
laughing.
Shit, that's good. But it's just, there's very few, like, any industries, let alone creative, where you have complete control over stuff, and it's quite powerful.
It's really powerful, and I think the reason I started doing it was because all of my friends are stand-ups, and I could see the control they had, especially Rod, the control he has. So he'll write something, goes and tries it out, goes, right, that bit not working, this bit, no, push this bit, that's okay, come off. It's so rewarding, and yeah, it's just such a great creative experience, isn't it? Whereas maybe sometimes handing something over that you have sweated over and handing it over to somebody who isn't in the same frame of mind, they're maybe getting a wage, you're not, handing it back and going, oh, you don't get it, you know, that, which is, you know, it's horses for courses, isn't it? Sometimes you can do that and it's wonderful and that works as well. But there's something incredibly magical about if you can do the character yourself, then it is that control thing. And people trust you more as well, because it's very difficult to say to a performer who's in character and is making people laugh, oh, don't say that because it's not funny. And you go, well, it is clearly, because I just said it and people were laughing.
Yeah, I was laughing.
Yeah. And I was laughing. And it, exactly. So there's definitely more control, and that's far more rewarding.
Yeah. What I was going to say was about the writing process. It's interesting thinking about when you're writing, but performing it as well as, you know, you're writing it, but the part of the writing process is the performing it. I was thinking like about, you know, particularly with that sitcom that you did, that I do, obviously some of the improvisation as well is part of that as well. There's an interesting way of I was thinking, like, does a lot of comedy get written like that, do you think?
Do you mean semi-improved? So improvised.
Well, I just meant, like, you know, even if you're in a writer's room with people, you're actually performing those moments, yes. and then writing them. You know, obviously writing it as you're performing it.
Yes, I think it depends on your character, doesn't it? Because I work with a really lovely man, Gareth Gwynn. Me and Gareth Gwynn and Tidder Owen, who's also brilliant. We wrote a tourist trap together, and so me and Tid are performing it, and Gareth's in it as well. But Gareth is definitely more writer and a producer, analytical, incredible gag writer, and you know structure and everything. And then Tid's and I are more performy, and we also do a sketch show together on S4C at the end of every year. And Tid's and I are in it, and Gareth is more of the writing. And I think it's into your character as well. So, for example, in a writer's room, I will do voices and accents, and I have no qualms about it. In fact, I love it, and that's how I make myself laugh and I make other people laugh. And I think other people are more, so that you're more writery, analytical. They don't do that. They are more likely to. I mean, they bounce off people, obviously. Mm, mm. You know, you're all improvising in the room. But you're not in character.
Yeah.
And I think when I was writing Man Down with Greg and I would be in character. I would play, Greg would play himself, Dan, and I would be playing Mike Wozniak's character and Rasheen's character.
Okay, yeah,
when
yeah.
we were, because I love it. I absolutely, and you get such funny stuff from that because you're in the moment doing funny voices and you're in the funny characters' brains. And it was quite. It could sound quite mad. So if I'm doing all the voices apart from Dan's, you know, it would sound mad. But we enjoyed it so much, and it's just a really useful thing to be able to do. I think because it takes you somewhere. Those characters show you things that you wouldn't necessarily see otherwise. They come out with stuff.
It's interesting because we're rewatching Man Down at the moment, actually, on Netflix.
Are you?
And it's brilliant. But it's those. They're all such unique voices. So that's really interesting that you were sort of playing all those multiple parts in the writing process. And you've got obviously got very, very, they've all got very distinctive sounds.
Yes, it was really, it was such a laugh, just such a laugh doing it. And also it was really weird because there was a point where I was doing, you know, it was in a read through, the proper read through with Channel 4. Where Mike Wozniak and Rasheen were actually there, you know, so that it's their voices, they're brilliant, they're really funny, where you'd go, oh, actually, when Sian was doing your voice, she said that word, she said that word differently. And it was like, love, you know, it was so weird, but it's such a great thing to be able to have in a writer's room, that ability to disappear into characters and they become alive.
Do you find, I find sometimes when I'm performing stuff, because I definitely get like anxiety about performing anything, really. I did two castings this morning and I was obviously like shitting it. One of them had to do a New Zealand accent, so that's possibly why. Which
give us a flavour.
I said to my agent, she was like, maybe just do it in your own accent.
Give us a flavour, Jim.
It was like fuck.
Sian and I are the producers, right?
I can't remember what the...
You're going to go, yeah, mate, let's put a couple of shrimps on the barbie.
Real.
Well, it flowed into Australian, like, and then back into my home county's accent as well. Yes. It was like a character. I'm I. Yes. Hello. Oh, God.
It's a bit South African, mate.
That went a bit Cockney, didn't it?
That went South African, I thought.
I've got a name. Oh, God, it was bad. No wonder if you said, just do it in your own accent, mate. It'd be
That's a really funny character to have, though. Somebody who dips in and out of, like, you know what I mean?
He's lived in so many different places. He's got this weird accent.
Multi-heritage. I can't help it. I'm just a man of the world. It's just where I'm from.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
We had this thing when me and Nell used to live together in Cardiff. We had this thing whenever there was a difficult subject to bring up, like bills with other flatmates, we'd all slip into Australian. We'd all slip into Australian accents. Yeah, and it was really odd. It was like, I can't be too angry. You know what I mean? Like,
does it soften the blow?
Yeah.
Oh, mate, you owe me 500 quid for
five,
the
500
for the phone.
Pounds.
Yeah. Struth, mate.
Company. Yeah. Are you going to pay the guest bill or do you know what I mean?
Mate, I'm kicking you out. You're leaving.
Yeah.
Get out of my house, mate.
Did you sleep with my husband?
Oh, you're flaming mongrels. You haven't done the dishwasher.
Yeah, and it was such a weird... When we noticed it, it was like, why do we do this? Where's the Australian coming from?
That's amazing.
The point I was trying to get to is, do you find sometimes when you're performing, because I try and break through the anxiety by just being like, fuck it. I'm just going to fucking go for this. Like, it doesn't... And if it's great, great. And if it's not, even better. Like, so what? Because you can't really hold back when you're doing that kind of stuff.
No, oh my God. That is numero uno. Right?
Numero uno, mate.
Is if you're on, especially if you're on stage, if you're having fun, the audience knows you're having fun. And if you're not having fun, the audience definitely know you're not having fun. They're like dogs. They can smell the fear. Yeah. They're going, she's not enjoying it. She's not enjoying it. This is awful. And then even if by any chance you are funny accidentally, they'll go, I'm not sure if we're meant to laugh. You know what I mean? You have to make them feel so confident. Yeah. And I think you have to trick yourself in a similar way, that sort of, this is fine. This is fine. You know, and enjoy it. Trick yourself into enjoy it. Writing's the same. If you're terrified, and I have been terrified in the past, you know, writing stuff under pressure, or if you're in a writer's room and you don't, you know, that feeling when you're starting out, maybe you don't know people very well, you're not sure if you're good enough, you're not sure if you're going to hit
the imposter syndrome kicks in.
Oh, totally. So, and you have to, it's a trick, because then the minute you start going, oh, I can do this, oh, let's see what happens if I do that, and add curiosity to it, then you start to enjoy it, and then it just grows and it grows. That's the key. I think it's also surrounding yourself with people you trust and like. Mm.
Yeah.
Because they have to be able to give you the green light.
Give yourself the green light as well.
Yes, totally. Totally. I think as well, especially for a woman, there's an added expectation that you also have to look sexy at the same time. And it's difficult to be a clown who's also sexy. Like, they're opposite. You can't quite combine them, you know? So you have to abandon that idea of looking good. You have to. And it's so difficult, because I've sometimes been in makeup chairs where the makeup woman's putting on some quite nice makeup, and I'm like, it's really nice, but I'm supposed to be playing a really rough barmaid. Yeah, and she's going, yeah, but you're going on TV, you want to look nice. And I had to go, no, I want to look rough. You know, like really awful. And she's going,
scrapes all the makeup off.
Yeah, just a flannel. But, you know, are you sure? Because it's going out on Christmas Day. And it was, you know, that thing of that battle. And part of me was going, actually, it would be quite nice to look nice on Christmas Day. But no, I don't need to look rough. Otherwise, the joke isn't going to work. And I wrote it, so I know we need this to look. But there is that added thing. But you can't. You have to be a clown. That's why, yeah, remind yourself that being a clown is all right. You have to go with it.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I was thinking it's interesting as well, that collaboration as well. We've talked about this before on the podcast, and how important it is to find those people that you can, you know, and how exciting it is when you do find those people that you can collaborate with.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
And the idea that sometimes, I guess, a bit like writing in general, comedy is so often seen as, particularly like with stand-up stuff, seen as quite a solitary thing. Whereas, you know, actually, a lot of the time it isn't. It is a collaboration. Sometimes it's a collaboration with the audience, isn't it? Because, you know, you're going on stage, you're doing routines. Some of them, absolutely, like you say, some of them might not work. So they're kind of giving you the cues to change stuff. So absolutely, it's interesting that collaboration in comedy.
Totally. The more confident you get as well. When you first start out, you're like, right, this is my script, and I've learned it off by heart, and I'm not going to even look at the audience, and I'm just going to say it. And then if they laugh, great. If they don't, I will get to the end and leave the stage. But the more confident you get, the more you're listening to the audience and like, oh, that man over there really enjoyed what I said there for some reason. And you go with it, and you can feel when you've lost them, and you can feel when they're And you may add in another line or dwell on something or come back to something because your brain takes over. And it is, Ellis used to say that. He used to say, you know, I write my show with the audience. So he will go on with a scrap of paper. And Ellis, such a brilliant storyteller, really genuinely funny. And, you know, he can just do it and he doesn't have that massive fear, which I have. But, you know, so you are writing it with an audience. But it is collaborative. You know, we've noticed on lockdown, me and Rod, we see our friends a lot through work. And it's only in lockdown that we've gone, oh my God, we're okay because we're working from home. We're seeing our friends on Zoom through work. So we've been lucky in that sense.
Yeah.
We collaborate with, and they're just, you become very, very good friends, I think, because you have to find, you have to be very vulnerable in front of each other if you're writing a sitcom together, which is such a long chunk of work. And also you mine each other's lives for ridiculous, awful stuff. So you're kind of like swapping. You're like war buddies. By the time you come out at the end, you have been through stuff.
You've overshared quite a lot.
You've overshared. Yeah, you've overshared. And it's lovely. I mean, you can create friends for life, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Collaboration is great.
But you have to be okay with, if you're being, that's true about being vulnerable. And I think that's good. That's how you connect with anyone on any level, really, is if you can be vulnerable and open with them. Like, certainly
Absolutely.
With creative work. But you then have to be open to someone saying, to you being vulnerable to give your idea, and someone saying, I don't know about that. Let's try in a different way. And that's horrible. It's a horrible feeling. But you have to be confident enough to go with that.
And again, you have to choose people who can tell you that in a way that isn't going to hurt. And it's trust, isn't it? Because you know if somebody says that to you, you trust that they still love you. They still think you're great. It's just that particular idea isn't right for this. And you're not going, oh my God, they hate me. Oh my God, I can't. And then you're paralyzed.
Yeah.
Oh God, that's such a horrible feeling. Have you guys ever been in that situation where you're just in a spiral of nobody likes me, nobody wants me to do this, you know, and so nothing can come because you're not, that's
I call
not
it Tuesdays.
How you're creating.
It happens a lot.
Is that a regular gig?
Yeah, my regular Tuesday gig. My regular Jim hates himself gig. It's great, audience of one.
Oh man,
and even he's a critic.
Be creative.
Yeah, and he fucking hates it. I think that happens to a lot of creative people, but it's
you can't be creative and scared. You cannot be creative and genuinely scared. Not just a bit of butterflies before going, you know what I mean? I mean, genuinely scared.
You'd just literally not put anything out there, would you, at all? And you know, every bit of creative work, whether it's art, music, comedy, acting, writing, whatever it might be, is there's a slice of you in there. So, you have to be I totally agree. I think we have to have that.
Yeah, you can't be paralysed.
No.
I've got a tip for being... somebody taught me that you can't be scared and curious at the same time. Mm. Like, it's physically impossible for your brain to do that, apparently. Oh. So if you force yourself to be curious, so say that you're doing something quite stressful, and then you force yourself to go, I wonder what happens if I do this, or I wonder what this is would be like. It kind of takes away the fear. So I've been trying to apply it to spiders because I'm really scared of spiders. And I'm trying to like look at a spider and go, oh, I wonder how he's feeling today. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder if I crush this spider with my hand.
If I will.
I wonder if I burn the house down with him inside if he'll survive.
Yes. But I think it works. I think the whole, when it comes to creative writing, it works. That kind of curious, I'm just going to give it a go. Let's see what happens. Oh, that's interesting. What if I move that there? That's really interesting. You know,
that's such
it's a lot
advice.
Of mind tricks.
But I was going to say also that curiosity is obviously comes back to that journalism stuff as well. Being curious about the world and all that kind of stuff is kind of, that's kind of been in there for you as well for a long time.
Yes, I think, I mean, it can be a something that you trip up over because I'm curious in everything. You know, I'm into everything. So it's well, that's really interesting. It's like, no, it's not really, is it? You know, and I get sidetracked very easily.
Down like Wikipedia rabbit holes.
Oh my god! or you know, anything. Me and Rod went for a walk the other day, and I was like, "Oh my god, this is so interesting." You know, like, yeah. Honestly, it's on. You'd be amazed. Like anything.
One foot in front of the other. I've never. It's unbelievable.
Isn't it amazing, darling? And that's how our conversations go. I'm going, "Oh my god, this is so interesting," and Rod's like. We have to get back to the car. You know what I mean? Just this curiosity about everything, which is brilliant, but also it takes up a lot of time, you know. You have to prioritize.
Isn't that a great way to live? To be curious. And yes. Also to be someone that laughs a lot. I think I do the same often, I think, out of nervousness or deflection. But either way, it's a nice environment to be in. To be curious and someone that laughs, I think it's the best way to live, surely.
It's kind of not, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's good. It is good, definitely. I think sometimes, yeah, you have to laugh at things, don't you? Like when awful things, I mean, it sounds really callous, but I have such a deep empathy for things. Me and Rod were talking about it yesterday. We've stopped listening to music as much as we used to, which is bizarre because we love music. We love music so much. But the reason I have is that music, I find it so evocative, and it could be anything. I find it so evocative and it has such an effect on me that it can turn my day. Like it can send me into the past or... Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And it's too much. It's too much, so I try to avoid it. It's really odd. And I need to get it back. I'm going to get it back in my life and manage it so that it's only good stuff. Because I tend to listen to stuff that makes me feel melancholy as well.
Well, I'm the same. Yeah. I listen to that kind of music. I prefer kind of melancholy music. Anything with a minor note does it for me. But
yes, me too.
I've been listening to more music recently, actually. More music. I've actually been quite kind of almost ravenous for music, going, getting like making loads of playlists and all sorts, and
that's great.
And actually it's been really lovely to re-engage a little bit with it. I think I play in a band and obviously we haven't been able to rehearse for months and months and months, so I think I'm just desperately craving like that side of stuff.
Totally.
So I'm sorry that you're having that, because I've had those moments as well where I've just been like, I can't listen to anything at the moment because I'm similar to you, I think. I easily get evoked by stuff.
I think it's not even a conscious thing.
No.
I've just phased it out. And also because I think it's weird. We don't, it's not like, I know we make it sound, it sounds like we're really ancient, but we don't have the same means of listening to music anymore. We
haven't got a wireless anymore.
Yeah, it used to be so easy, didn't it? It used to be so much easier, I find. Because now, I don't know, I have an iPod, but I've kind of lost it. And then do I actually own the songs, or do iTunes own them? What do we do? You know when you change computers, and then it's like, well, have I still got my music then? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, God.
It's all kind of up in the air.
iTunes I still can't fathom iTunes and the way it syncs stuff. Why I've got Spotify now, because it's just easier. Yeah.
Really?
But I think actually, we've talked about this before as well on the podcast, that we don't listen to music in the same way anymore. You know, back in the day, you'd listen to an album.
Yeah.
And we don't really listen to albums the same way now. It's all sort of, you know, we should put everything on shuffle almost, don't we? So I think that's something I'd like to get back to, is actually listening to full albums and being immersed in something.
But also sharing it with other people, because we used to share it so that it was on the radio or, you know, it's that communal experience, isn't it? Whereas now you're more likely to download a link on your own, listen to it, and then not talk to anyone about it ever. Mm. And it's like, well, what's the point then? Like, you went on that little journey for no reason at all. The best thing is the communal.
That feeling of sharing music with someone that you care about, or music that means a lot to you, is really powerful. I've got really, during lockdown, I've got really into Jamie Cullum. Because my wife loves Jamie Cullum. And I used to think he was so lame. I thought he was rubbish. And actually,
if you're listening, Jamie, you're welcome on the podcast anytime.
They live here, Sophie Dahl live really close to us, actually.
Put a note for the door.
Yeah, I'll go around and knock. I'm like, I used to think you were lame, but actually I think you were right.
You've made it into my good books now, Jamie.
He's actually really good. He's really talented. But because Miranda will listen to Jamie Cullen. But the other day, he's got a Christmas album out and she bought his Christmas album on CD. And we do not have a CD player anywhere in the house. But she bought it
to have that physical...
And she bought it and we'll listen to it on Spotify. We will not listen to it on the CD. I guarantee it will never happen if we don't have a CD player.
Coaster.
But there's something about having the physical form of it. And I guess maybe supporting the artists and stuff.
Yeah, supporting the artists, I believe, is good. Yeah.
But having it in your hand, you know, that thing of you're reading the back cover, you read the words, you look at the pictures, the artwork, and it's so, oh my God, it was delicious. I can't handle the what's the word? It doesn't exist anymore.
Like
it's like, yeah, the cloud. I don't like it. I don't like it. I like knowing what I own, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's funny, my friend has just bought, last year he bought a proper turntable stylus. And, got some new speakers, got a really nice setup in his house. And we went round, when the new Queens of the Stone Age album came out, we went round, he bought it on vinyl. It cost him like 50 quid.
Yeah,
but I tell you what, it was ridiculous, but it was worth it.
And
there was four records in it. And so you had to keep changing it over every two songs. I'm actually sort of saying all the sort of negative parts of it, but it was great.
But it was really fun.
You better get up again. Tom, you better get up again, mate. There's a song just about to finish. Turn it over.
Oh, but it is. It's magical.
It is special. It is special.
Isn't it? Yeah. When you go to a friend's house and they've got a vinyl going and they've got some like a little lights going and you have a glass of wine together and it's so magical. Yeah. I just don't know why we don't do it all the time. I guess it's the, the evocativeness. Yes, I have to. We're going to try and get back into it, but manage it more so that I can only listen to music that line up with what I need to do. So it's, you know, hospital appointment.
What would be your hospital appointment?
What do you listen to?
Yeah, what are you going to put on?
Casualty, like the theme tuned. I don't know.
Don't put that on.
But you know, or something like she's
Help
getting it
by
done.
The
you know, things. Like nothing that reminds me of my youth. Mm. Because when I listen to music that reminds me of my youth, I get kind of rebellious and I want to go out. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to avoid that.
Is it certain nothing songs?
Then, so what would be, what
evoke these?
Yeah, I was going to say, what? Let's have this out,
I don't
Tom.
Know.
What are they?
Baby Shambles or Stone Roses or anything that makes, you know what I mean? That kind of thing that makes you want to jump around and drink a lot and do things. And it'll be in the morning. So I'm like, I can't do that right now. Honestly, songs are so, I'm so suggestive. They can just put me in the, and I should harness this power. I know a lot of people who actually write whilst listening to music because it helps them channel stuff.
Yeah, I do.
I need to do that. Do you?
Yeah.
I need to do that more.
Yeah, I do actually. Because I find it does evoke, it's particularly if I'm writing, when I've written a couple of novels, and actually it was amazing when I was doing those because I made playlists in the end because it was so good for getting into a headspace, you know, and say finding those emotions that you need, whether it be sort of sad or happy.
That's amazing. It's such a good... It's so amazing that we can control our emotions like that. Isn't it? It's just when you're on the way into town or something, you're like, I can't do this now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm listening to Bolero.
Oh, my wife, Miranda, was going to either a casting or something into London. And we live in Chesham in Buckinghamshire. She got the train from Amersham all the way into Marylebone. Was so engrossed in the music she was listening to, didn't get off at Marylebone, didn't notice everyone else got off, and was halfway back to Harrow when she realised she was going the wrong way. Because she was so engrossed.
What was she listening to?
I can't remember.
Wasn't Jamie Cullum?
Probably Jamie Cullum.
I can totally relate to that. I would absolutely do that. I have done that reading before. Yeah. I used to temp somewhere where I had to get the train. And literally... Every week would be, I'm really sorry. Do you know what I mean? They turn up 40 minutes late. I'm so sorry. it's a really good book. I'll lend it to you afterwards. It's so easily done.
But I wonder if like as a nation, are we turning off from music a little bit? You know, with the spoken word and, you know, like podcasts and stuff come into fruition. Are we listening to more conversations now and not less music?
It's strange, isn't it? Because on lockdown, I watched a live. Rod's cousin is a fantastic cellist, Gabriella Swallow. She's brilliant, and she lives down the road from us. And she did a live concert on Zoom, and so a lot of people, you can sign in, you donate to pay the. They're incredible, world class performers, all classical, and they play live, and it's like a Zoom chat, so you can see other people watching them from their living rooms. And oh gosh, and it was because we hadn't seen live music for so long, but both me and Rod were just in absolute floods watching it, because you can see elderly couples just in their front room having a glass of wine together. Wow. And it was that communal experience again of, oh, we miss it so much. There's nothing can beat it. Nothing can beat that. Everyone listening to the same piece of music live. It's just otherworldly. I think it transcends anything, and I can't wait for that. I'm going to every gig going. Once this is over, I'm going to everything. Yeah. You know, we took it for granted. We took it so much for granted.
Live music, there is something very special about live music, I have to say. Yeah, I think actually for me, over other types of performances, I think something about music just sends shivers down my spine sometimes. Oh,
incredible. And you can actually watch bands that you weren't really into before live, and if they're great live, you're like, actually, I totally get it now. Yeah. I totally get it.
Yeah.
I felt like that about Coldplay. Didn't like Coldplay. I was like, no. Saw them in Glastonbury. I was like, oh my God. I totally get it. I totally get what you mean. It's so magical. I think it's more difficult to... Well, for me personally, it is, as I was saying, more difficult to get your hands on. I don't know where to find music or how to organise it in my brain, you know? So it's all kind of all over the place. It's not a shelf of neat records anymore.
No.
It's what computer is it on, and have we got, you know? Yeah. God.
But maybe you should do that for you, though. Maybe you should just get a record player and buy some vinyl, and then you've got your way of doing it. I think that's...
Yeah. Yes.
Take
control of it.
Take control of it, guys.
Yeah.
That's what I should do. I am. You know what? I am. We've got a... That's the thing. We have one. It's just actually get... You know, because your brain does weird things, doesn't it? They'll go, well, they won't have that song on vinyl, you know, or something.
They're re-releasing everything. I think you can get pretty much... everything again now on vinyl.
I'm going to get into it. I am going to get into it because, I love it so much. And I think, I was thinking yesterday, what a tragic tale if you reach a certain age and then you just don't listen to something that was so important in your first bit of life, you know? Mm. That kind of, I'm definitely, I'm going to change it. I am.
Yeah, it's a good idea. We've got a shed that's got all my old CDs in a couple of big boxes, which... Actually, they've been out there for a couple of years now, so they've probably died in the winter, to be fair. But I don't need the CD. I just need the box so I can see what CD that was and then see if I can listen to it on Spotify, because there'll be loads out there that mean stuff to me that I haven't even thought about for years.
And you totally forget.
Yeah.
And when you hear them, it's like, oh my God. It is like a time portal, isn't it? Yeah. You can literally just open a door and go, oh, hello. Yeah. Oh, hello, Ice Rink 96.
Hello, Heartbreak 98.
Yeah, exactly.
Hello, cleaning job. Hello, early morning cleaning job 1997.
Yeah. It's true, though. It takes you back to real places. That's so true.
I can't still listen to that therapy album from that cleaning job. Oh, it gives me stomachache when I put that on.
But it is so odd, isn't it? I remember yesterday we were in art gallery, and this song came on, and it was the song that they played just before my Edinburgh show, and I just got immediate kind of, oh, why do I feel sick? Oh, right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, we haven't got a show now, have we?
Start performing in the middle of the gallery. What was the song? Can you remember?
Oh my gosh, what was it? It was I don't remember the title of it, but it's a bit jazzy. And then at the end it goes No. Oh, I'll remember will I remember it towards the end? No. No, I don't remember
right.
It
though. Yeah, that's right.
Sorry. Yes, it's brilliant what music can do to your brain, though. Yeah.
It is. I think also, actually, for me, sometimes it does spur on or inspire me, I should say, in other ways, like with other art forms. I think I put on a song sometimes, and I'll start thinking of words and lyrics, and then yeah. it will start flooding my head with other ideas. So I think, yeah,
absolutely,
you need to dive back in, Sian, if you can.
I love lyrics as well. I think that's part of the problem. If there are some good lyrics going on, then I'm in absolute heaven. You know, music isn't just a tune. It's a proper... I get too involved. You know, like too involved. I can be, you know, late night in the kitchen saying to Rod, oh my God, do you know what this means? Like this, you know, tears in my eyes. And Rod has to go, I had never really thought about it. Like,
it's know? YMCA. It's
yeah, because I say, Sean, it's Eye of the Tiger. It was in Rocky III.
Yeah, there's really no levels to this one, to be honest.
But it can get, it just gets exhausting. Did you used to listen to music over and over and over?
Yeah, I still do.
Yeah.
I've realised, well, because Spotify, I don't know if you've had this, Jim, they email all their users to tell them what they've been listening to throughout the year. Right. And then tell you how many times you've listened to them and how many. I've listened to music I worked out for 21 days this year.
Wow. Really?
21 whole days I've listened to music. 30,465 hours of listening.
Wow.
Which seems stupid amounts. I haven't really gotten anywhere. So I don't know where I'm listening to all this music. But there are certain songs that are clearly I've just listened to death to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It's always been the brilliant thing about live music and live comedy. Live, you know, musicians can play that song over and over and over on stage, and if anything it gets better because people love it more and they want to hear it again. But then you know, you can't do that with comedy. You can't do your act over and over and over because people will start to get a bit, mind you, I used to watch comedy stand-up all the time. Eddie Izzard used to watch it over and over.
The Immaculate Collection was I had that on VHS. I think it just wore out in the end.
It just wore out because
it was so good.
But I find comedy, like music, is very musical. The rhythms of it. I used to love Victoria Wood because she was very musical, and I used to find her comedy very tuneful. You know, the rhythm, the way she delivered stuff. It was very obvious that she also did music.
Mm. Yeah, who were your comedy heroes then, Sian?
Well, Victoria Wood, Rick Mayall. Definitely. I remember watching him. I think I was really young when I watched him do Jack and Ori. I think I was about 5.
Was that when he did George's Marvelous Medicine?
Yes.
Yeah, so good.
That's the best TV I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And because I was so little, I was 5, so I used to watch it after coming back from playgroup. And you know, you're not in charge of the schedule, are you, when you're 5? Yeah. So you'd just, your mum would plunk you down in front of the TV, and you'd be like, I hope that man comes on again. You know, I had no concept of what it was. And he would just come on every night and just, oh my God, magical. So funny and mesmerizing and wonderful. And then obviously I really liked Bottom. I was a bit too young for the young ones, but I loved Bottom when that came out. It came out just at the right time where I was finding, you know, swearing and being silly and falling over, that funny. And it was wonderful. So yeah, and Alan Partridge as well, Steve Coogan, he was a huge influence.
Yeah,
me and Alice were obsessed. Yeah. What about you guys?
Well, yeah, I think my sort of comedy awakenings were things like things like Fawlty Towers and stuff. But then I guess later on, it would have been things like, I guess when my teenage years, it was things like Newman and Badil, Blackadder.
Amazing. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, those kind of things, I guess. Mm. 11 o'clock show, a little bit.
yeah, was, oh God, I love that.
Slightly later, but yeah, that was great.
Yeah, that was, because is that where Ricky Gervais started?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was Ian Lee, so wasn't funny. It? Ian Lee hosted it.
Yeah, Ian Lee was brilliant. Yeah. And Daisy Donovan.
Yeah, and then it was also incredible. Daisy Donovan was brilliant. And then obviously Ali G and and Sacha Baron Cohen came out of that as well. So it was a brilliant show.
God, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Well, but the first, when I was really little, I had like about two or three, I got cystitis or like it was a bladder infection. And the only way my parents could stop me from crying was to put Fawlty Towers on. That was the only way that they could stop me from crying. Yes. So it was something about the rhythm and the nonsense that just calmed me down. So that's such an early lesson in laughter will stop everything else being bad.
It's true.
Yeah. So I just loved it, and we had it on vinyl as well. So
did you? Oh, okay.
Hearing that rhythm. Fawlty Towers on vinyl. Because you've seen it so many times, you know exactly what they're doing. But so when there's a gap and the audience are just laughing, you know what's going on in that studio. It's magical. So nice.
I remember listening to Peter Cook and Dudley Moore sketches on audio as well from like the radio. And those sketches, particularly the Pete and Dud sketches, when they're the two blokes just having their sandwiches, eating, drinking pints, it's just sensational. It's just so good. Like they say, like the rhythm of it. And also the sort of in joke, like them trying to get each other to laugh as well, which is quite good as well. I think I like that kind of stuff.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, brilliant stuff.
That's really interesting, the idea of watching live comedy, listening to the audio of live of sitcom.
Thank you.
That's really, I guess it makes you appreciate the sort of writing and delivery more, because it's more of a sort of visceral thing. It's right there in your head. I've never even considered that.
Absolutely. And well, I don't think it was an intentional. I think they just, my parents and my grandparents loved comedy, so I think they had it. And it's also their favorite episode. It's the one with Mrs. Richards, you know, the one with the she's incredible. So it's so funny. And yeah, you're right. Just listening to the words and the pauses. It's such a lesson in, you can get a laugh by not saying anything sometimes in front of an audience. Especially if you trick them, you know. If there's a pattern and there's like it's a rule of three, and then the third one, you're just quiet. You know, and it's so good. Just such a box of tricks.
Yeah.
Well, Sian, obviously this podcast is about blank moments, and we've kind of talked about writers' rooms and stuff. Have you ever had any moments where you've had sort of like a blank, or, you know, or even in performing, actually, any sort of the sort of blank moments you may have had during your years?
Let's think. I once said, oh God, it was in a sketch with Superclump. And I was in a sketch with Nat Latsema where I was playing Little Red Riding Hood and she was the grandmother. And it wasn't necessarily blank, but for some reason, instead of saying, "Grandma, what big teeth you have," it came out as tits. And the audience didn't quite understand what I'd say. It was that rule of three thing again. Didn't quite understand because I lost confidence. So they were like, "Did she say tits?" So instead of laughing, they were all like, "Did she say tits?" And it was excruciating because Nat Lover was like, "What?"
I know they're impressive, but that's not the line.
And then we just had to fizzle the sketch out because I didn't have enough confidence. I didn't have enough experience or confidence to just kind of go, I know it all sounded like I said tits.
Own it.
You know, own it. Yeah. I was just like, oh God. Yeah. It was like being in a it's like being in a school play. Oh my God. So that's not necessarily a blank. I think it's that, I can't think of a specific one. It's being terrified and not being able to write gags. I'm trying to think of an example. Oh, it's that knowing. When I first started out, I was in a writer's room. I won't say which one, but they go round the table asking you to come up with what you've done. So to read out the jokes that you've done. And knowing that that was going to happen, I just could not write anything. Yeah. I just couldn't write anything because it's terrifying. It's that fear, isn't it? Of like, oh, we're going to be coming to you and we want to hear what you say.
Yeah.
And I've just learned that I don't perform well in that situation. I would much prefer it to be a kind of conversation where everyone's going to, well, we're going to try this and maybe what about that? And so whenever I'm holding writers' groups, I'm always trying to be very, we are not coming to you and doing that. It's going to be more of a conversation where you can chip in whenever you want and add stuff. It's far more collaborative and it's not as terrifying. I personally don't perform well in that situation.
But everyone's different. There might be some people that do.
Absolutely. Exactly. Some people love it. Some people need that adrenaline in order to get something down.
Yeah.
I don't. I need to trick myself and do that whole roundy thing of like, oh, isn't it interesting? You know, and totally trick myself or become a character. Or just absolutely trust every single person in that room so I know, they're all right. It doesn't matter if I mess up.
Yeah.
It's that expectation, isn't it?
Yeah.
That perfectionism, it's so bad for you.
100%.
Always.
But 9 times out of 10, actually no, 99 times out of 100. Actually no, 100 times out of 100. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. No.
Like, that's really powerful to say to yourself, I think. It doesn't matter. If it goes really badly, it doesn't matter. It'll be another day, like whatever. It's just, it happens.
Exactly.
It's never going to be as bad as you think it's going to be.
And also with writing scripts, you know, when I first set it out, I would agonize over how to start it, how would it go, oh my God, it takes so long over it. Whereas now I do a first draft, which nobody is going to see.
Yeah.
Nobody. Not even myself. You know what I mean? There's bits in there that I'm like, oh my God. So what I do, I call it the dog shit draft. And I bash the dog shit draft. No one is ever getting into that file. And I just bash it out. All of it. All in one go. This could happen. Or maybe this could happen. And it's all in third person with a bit of dialogue shoved in if it pops into my head. And I bash it all out and then I leave it for a few weeks and I come back to it. And that's when I have a lump of clay or dog shit to play with.
We'll say clay.
Clay.
You don't want to be moulding dog shit, yeah.
Is this any good?
It smells a bit. It's just,
right. Yeah, I mean, you know. So that's when it's... And then you can go, okay, well, that's insane. But that's actually quite a funny idea. You know what I mean? So, and then you start to have something. It's getting over that first... Somebody taught me that momentum is the most important thing. That momentum.
Yeah.
Because when you have it, it's like a train and you can't stop it. You're on track. You're going to make it. But you have to trick yourself into doing that. And that can be anything that helps you, really. I find post-it notes really helpful. Post-it notes are really helpful because they're tiny.
Post-it notes, yeah.
Oh, they're incredible. They're so small and you can move them around.
And they're sticky.
Get rid of them if you want. Yeah, and they're colourful and they're fun. So it doesn't feel like work. It's tricking yourself into stuff.
Stationery is always good, I think.
Oh my gosh, I'm obsessed. How many notebooks do you get through?
Oh, I've got so many. Got like, they're all upstairs, actually. Loads.
Yeah.
And loads of them are like, they've all been used as well. It's not like a new one. They've all got like, you know, I think I forget that I've got one on the go and then start another one.
Yeah, that's what I do.
And I'm like, oh, shit, I've got like, I've got like half a dozen unfinished notebooks.
Yeah, me too. Just shelves full of them.
Yeah.
I've actually lost my, not lucky, a kind of lucky red notebook. I can't find it anywhere.
Oh, no.
It's my main one, yeah.
Has it got all your best gags in it?
All my best work. Oh, someone else had to discover it. They would commission literally none of it.
Is it like when Bob Monkhouse lost all his material?
Oh, yeah.
It's exactly like that.
It's like that. It's like that moment.
What happened with that? Did somebody break into his house and they nicked it?
I thought he'd lost it on like public transport or something. Or did they... I might be getting this whole completely wrong. And apologies to Bob God rest his soul. But I thought I thought he'd just like lost them in a briefcase. He can't have been carrying around all his time. It'd be a big old suitcase, wouldn't it, full of stuff.
In my head, it was like the scene in Ghostbusters at the beginning where there's loads of like little drawers with reference cards and somebody's like going through them with a torch. But I was just wondering, has somebody ever come up with a lot of Bob Monkhouse gags? You know,
what have they
done with them?
Is it, I mean... Who knows? Is Jimmy Carr using all of Bob's material? I mean, I'm not insinuating anything.
Wow, that's a big accusation. We might have to go to our lawyers for that one and run that through legal.
It's only because they've got similar haircuts.
That's the secret.
Yeah, it's a secret. It's the black swept back
that
hair.
That is a good idea, though, isn't it? That somebody out there is using Bob Monkhouse stuff. But from the late 90s.
So not the gold.
Exactly.
Someone's doing the circuit and
he's doing the cruise lines. They're probably going down a storm, actually, in the cruise
lines. Yeah, they're making a killing. Oh, you know that guy, he's so good.
Well, not now, obviously.
Reminds me of Bob Monkhouse.
Yeah, not now.
Well, Sian, it's been such a pleasure. We've run out of time, unfortunately. But it's been so lovely to talk to you.
It's been so lovely to talk to you both.
Thank you so much.
I don't think I've laughed as much on an episode, to be honest.
No, I don't think I have either.
Yeah.
Oh, it's infectious. That's such a nice...
Yeah,
it is.
It's because you're in the presence of the giggler.
Yeah, exactly.
It's always going to happen.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's a pleasure.
I've thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Good.
I'm off. You too. I'm off to buy a Christmas tree.
Are you?
Oh, cool.
Yes. I know. Super exciting.
Well, we always have an artificial tree, but my wife did buy a little real tree that we've got in here in this room. So,
that's nice.
I don't know if I can turn this round.
Can you show it? Oh, there, nice view. Oh, there, beautiful. Nice
little, so it's only a little one, but it's... Yeah. So what are you going to get? Still... A big 5, 6? Seven,
no,
eight, 9 foot.
We'll get a little. We get a little one. We usually get one from the garden, as in we had a bush that we took in and out and decorated it, but it's died.
Oh, we had that.
So, I know. Mm. It's and it was looking pretty grim last year. So we're gonna buy one. I don't really like the idea of chopping a tree down, but I think we're gonna do it this year. Not chop.
If you get one potted though, you can reuse it.
Yes. I mean, you say that. This is somebody who can't even buy a vinyl, you know. Yes. No, but that is a good idea. May I ask somebody to help?
In theory, it's going to be a good idea.
In theory, I will do that. Thank you so much, Sian. Loves.
Thanks, Sian.
Yeah.
It's been
Take
lovely
care yourself,
to speak
and I'm,
to you.
Oh, I'm sure we'll speak soon anyway.
And you.
Well, there you go. We said that we laughed a lot in that episode. I mean, that was, I'm going to say 50% laughter, I think, in that one.
75%.
Whoa. Yeah, it might have been. Maybe someone can listen back and do the numbers for us. But yeah, what fun.
Yeah, it was brilliant fun. And I was able to tell some old anecdotes from yesteryear, from school plays to vinyl collections.
You've held on to that. Which anecdote was it? You'd held on to one of them for a long time.
My school, so it was our year six leavers assembly, and I was involved in the staff room sketch.
had you intentionally held on to that anecdote? Because actually I feel like you chose the perfect episode to reveal it in.
No, I've been trying to segue it into all the podcasts. It just happened that this week was the time that I could reveal it.
Well, hey, comedy is about timing, so you timed
exactly
perfectly.
Yeah, that was a brilliant, brilliant episode. Sian is lovely, lovely person and great company.
Great company. Again, I know obviously it's great we can connect over Zoom and stuff, but one of our guests it would have been lovely to have actually spent time in the same room with. And hopefully, again, like with most of our guests, we'll be able to sort of catch up once we're all allowed to have a cup of tea and a cup of coffee. And so much great advice. I mean, the dog shit draft, I mean, I'm going to start calling my first drafts that. That is spot on. And the bit she said about... curiosity and being scared that can't coexist, which is so true. And I think every time we have these episodes with creative people, it always leaves me feeling way more confident about
the creative stuff I do. I mean, that would dissipate, I'd say, within about 12 hours. But at least I have that time. But it's just interesting that we all share the same neuroses and anxieties. And but it is empowering when you have someone as funny and as great to be around as Sean giving you that advice. So yeah, I just really
appreciate it. Yeah, and she's had such huge success with shows that she's been involved in. So, you know, it's always great to hear from people that are doing so well.
Yeah.
And it's always reassuring, isn't it, to know that we're all often on the same page.
Indeed, indeed. Well, thank you, Sean, for joining us. What a fantastic guest. I really enjoyed today's episode.
Yeah, brilliant.
If you'd like to get in contact with us and let us know past episodes you've liked or future guests you want to see on anything, we'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us, Facebook us, or Instagram us at
Blank Pod.
Or if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. Our email address is
theblankpodcast2018@gmail.com.
And this is our first episode back after Christmas break. So
it is.
It's lovely.
I hope you had
to
a nice
be back.
Christmas.
I did. Did you?
Yes, very nice. Thank you.
We hope our listeners did as well. And it means we're back now in the swing of doing these pods. They'll be back with you every Tuesday morning. So yeah, feels good to be back.
It does. Always feels good to be back.
Let me just do one that in case we don't use it. So there you go. That's the end of this week's pod. Great guest. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Giles, for one, being you, and two, sharing that great story from school.
Thank you, Jim.
And that's it. Have a great week. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, stay safe. I'll see you again soon. Bye.
When you're not feeling well, we're here for you. With Livy, our GPs are always here for you when you need them. So you can see an NHS GP by video, the same day, 7 days a week. Livy is a free service offered by many GP practices in this area. Download the Livy app now or check livi.co.uk to see if your practice offers Livy. Livy. See an NHS GP by video.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.